afternoon. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and you're listening to WCBN FM Ann Arbor. Today, I'm so happy to have in the studio Tayimba Jess here, the book on the table with us, Olio. Tayimba, thanks for being here.
It's great being back in Michigan.
Yeah.
Is it, home state.
Is it feeling good?
It's my home stomping ground, you know?
Yes. Well, okay. We got to talk about that. But before we get too far away from the song, thanks for picking today's music. And
it was a pleasure.
Why this song and why to lead in?
That is from a fantastic album. I would really suggest you get it. It's called Second Nature. It's Lurie Bell and Carrie Bell. Lurie Bell and Carrie Bell. Carrey. They're father and son. Father was singing and on the harmonica. Son was Lurie. He was on the guitar. It's really going back to, you know, the roots of American music. You know, the blues. You know, and I'm a real aficionado of the blues. I think that it centers my understanding of how to exist, how to perpetuate, how to resist in this nation state and in the world. And it's fortified me even when the title of the cut is Heartaches and Pain. It is about resistance, and to a certain degree it's about resilience.
I thank you for saying that, because I feel like that is the song that I needed for today. Somehow, I don't know how this was managed, but and you, I love how you said, and the father was singing on the harmonica.
He was doing both. He was singing and, well, he hadn't gotten to
so
the point,
the vocals,
but he does sing. He plays the harmonica on that cut.
Okay, we just hadn't gotten far enough. Well, I will be listening, because that is a song.
Second Nature.
Second Nature and the Lurie's. Mm-hmm. That is a song for today and the time that we're in.
Yeah.
And so today we get to talk about your book, Olio, Pulitzer Prize winning book.
Shocked
me. We should say that, right?
yes.
Wait, you say shocked, but I mean, this, once it happens, then you can't think of it otherwise.
That's kind of you to say thank you.
But how does it change? How does it change, like, the, because this book and the acknowledgments in Olio, out with Wave Book Press, the first line, if you don't mind me reading it, is, this book was a long series of stagger and stumble and getting up off the ground again.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It sure was. It was basically, you know, 7 or 8 year journey writing that book. It was excuse me. It was started one direction, ended up going a few other different directions before it ended up resolving itself into, you know, the book that eventually manifested. It was a journey of discovery. It was there were a lot of dead ends. There weren't really dead ends. They were just discoveries that I somehow couldn't manifest in the manuscript. And a lot of experimentation, butting my head up against walls until they kind of folded in and made something different.
Resilience.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, resilience
in the making.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it was a long meditation. Very long meditation. Yeah.
Well, you got to say more about that then.
Well, you know,
if you don't mind,
I think that it started off basically. I wrote a book. The book I wrote before this was called Lead Belly, and Lead Belly is an investigation of the man Lead Belly, Hoodie Ledbetter, who was born mid-1880s, died 1949 in New York, was king of the 12-string guitar. It was an amazing lyricist and a carrier of tradition, so to speak. I followed his life. I wrote a kind of a biography in verse of Lead Belly.
and that won the National Book Circle Award.
It won the National Poetry Series.
National Poetry Series, thank you.
Yes, and that was very fortunate. It really, you know, took me into different places. And then I started wondering about, you know, well, what's next? And I think that in writing about Lead Belly, I became intrigued about, well, who were the people that influenced Lead Belly? Who were the people that were active, so to speak?
Because he's the carrier of history in a way, you said. So
yeah.
Who were those that he was carrying with him?
Right. Yeah. And who? And additionally, what was the sound of black music before the era of recording? And that... It occurred to me that I really did not have a clear idea of what that looked like, and thus began a journey into discovering people like Blind Tom, Blind Boone, Sissy Retta Jones, the Fish Jubilee, you know, singers, Burt Williams, people who were really just engaged in arts and engaged in self-expression immediately after the Civil War. So you had this flood of black folks who were all of a sudden freed to do many things, and among those things that they were doing was artistic pursuit. And what did that feel like? What did that look like? Who were those people? What were they achieving? How were they reacting to the world around them that was in the nadir of race relations going through Reconstruction and out into World War I? And that's the people I ended up with. You know, Scott Joplin as well plays a role in the book. W.E.B. Du Bois is kind of called upon in the book in a certain way. Lots of Ebonia Lewis, the sculptor, who was part Native American, part black. Her Native American name was Wildfire. She's in the book. So it was really a journey for me of discovery of these people. And also, it made me mad that I had not found out about these people much earlier in life. They had fascinating journeys, and
because it was a hard journey, like this research. What was the research like? Like, how did? Because once you got the feel for it, like, who was first, or was it chronological, or did it just start happening?
The first one that I wrote about was Blind Tom, and Blind Tom, you know, was one of the more has an interesting history. You know, he was autistic, A-U-T-I-S-T-I-C, autistic, and or, you know, there's an argument that he was playing some kind of role as an autistic person. You know, the take that I have on Blind Tom is that he was gifted in a different kind of way. He did have a phonographic memory. If he heard something, he remembered it completely. So if excuse me, if he heard something on the piano, he could play it back note for note. And he retained that throughout his life, and he became exploited by the people that owned him. They lived in Georgia, and they basically kept him as part of their what would you say, is part of their household, is part of their holdings throughout the entirety of his life.
Yeah.
And he earned that family about $1 million throughout his entire life. That's $1 million in 19th century money.
Yeah.
So it's quite a large sum of money.
Like almost unthinkable.
Yeah, it was like a living, breathing corporation for them. And he started the journey, and then I started to stumble in studying him. I started to stumble across other people that were just, you know, that I had not heard of, that I, you know, wasn't really, you know, aware of who they, what they had done, and they intrigued me, and it just kind of led from one to the other to the other to the other, so to speak.
And did it? Were you in the archives? Like, how did you find Blind Tom? Like, what were some of the threads that you began to follow, or documents? Like, there archival, because that's what it's interesting to think about, the research that you had, this journey of discovery, but then your imagined time with the material,
right,
to create Olia, like to create like who Blind Tom is as a full, like as a full person of history.
Yeah, you know, I in the book I have a bibliography in the back of the book, which has, you know, extensive listing of the various books that I was able to access in order to make this research happen. There's also a timeline in the back of the book, which kind of, you know, gives an idea of when these things happened. I thought that was really, frankly, helpful for me to keep all these dates straight. So otherwise, it gets really a little bit confusing. But, you know, I can call some in particular. You know, one great starting place was this book by Lynn Abbott and Doug Suroff, Out of Sight, the Rise of African American Popular Music, 1889, I think, to
1895.
That was a really, really important piece of work. It kind of gave me a guide map. There's a lot of other books that I was able to access. I went to the library, looked up everything that I could about everybody that was in the book. You know, another interesting one was Henry Box Brown. He's in the book. He came in the book because Henry Box Brown is known for putting himself in a box in Virginia and mailing himself to Freedom in Philadelphia. Very interesting fella. He wrote a slave narrative about it afterwards, in which it gives a scathing account of his days in slavery and the way they exploited religion in particular, and exploited religion. Had this community build a church, then the white folks took the church instead of letting the black community have it. Then basically his master sold his wife and his three kids down the river. And at that point he was like, okay, I'm out. And he devised this plan in order to have himself mailed to Philadelphia, win the box, fortunately made the passage through, you know, the postal system, so to speak.
Like, would it be like the horse and carriage?
Yeah, it would be on a train.
Or a train then, okay.
On a box on a train, two and a half by 3 feet. Came out of the box literally singing. Then wrote his narrative, was chased down and nearly dragged back into slavery. Because this was I think 1859, I think, was when the Fugitive Slave Act was passed. I may have that date a little bit wrong. But essentially, after the Fugitive Slave Act was passed, they came for him hard. And he was like, you know what? I'm out.
Because then folks crossed the border.
You could legally cross the border.
Oh, find some. This is echoes of history. Yes. Like right now is feeling somewhat strong, too.
Yeah. You could legally cross the Mason-Dixon line, go up, you know, and claim that some black person who may or may not have been, you know, have escaped from slavery and then drag them back into slavery and get a reward for it, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
Yeah. And if you were caught, if you were caught harboring slaves, you were subject to penalty by law. Mm-hmm. So at any rate, he decided to leave the country, went to England. The reason he got in the book is because he himself became a performer. In England, performing, it was 1849 that the Fugitive Slave Act was passed, performing a kind of rendition of the Atlantic slave trade, and then with it culminating in his particular escape from slavery. He did that for until the end of the Civil War. And then he became a mesmerist. and had just a very interesting career. So he became a kind of a theater personality, so to speak.
Which connects to the McCoy twins and other aspects where it's almost like if people are able to be in some sort of performance or circus or something,
right?
Then they have this chance at some maybe different kind of life.
Yeah, it's the McCoy twins were an interesting situation. They McCoy twins were born Pygopagus twins. That means they were essentially joined from the more or less the middle of the back all the way through the pelvis. Born that way. Very, very, very rare for a set of Pygopagus twins to A, be born, and B, to survive. They were born in North Carolina, survived. What their master decided to do in order to get profit from what he perceived as his property and were legally at the time his property, he decided to put them in a traveling freak show, which went all around the various counties and whatnot in towns and villages, and sell a glance at them or for a certain prescribed amount. And so he kind of, you know, got a middleman to do this activity. And it was profitable until this guy saw that it was so profitable that the middleman took them to England. He kidnapped them, took them to England. And he decided to set up the whole thing alone by himself without having to share the profits. So the master decided to take their mother with him on a trip to England on a boat and then walk up on their performance because they were being advertised, etc. And then the kids see their mom for the first time in months and they say, "Mommy." And that is part of his claim of ownership. Yeah.
How did you, because I know it's so hard, like once I could actually sit here and listen to all the stories that like, because it's so like, it's also to see how you're like you're in the story as you're speaking them. And I wonder with the poems, like you're in them. Like, we'll just say that.
Well, they're all persona poems. So they're in first person from the perspective of generally the performer, so to speak, and sometimes people around that performer.
And so how many, like, I mean, maybe we could go to that part of the book. Would you want to read part of, because there's so many... There's so much to talk about Olio. If this is a book where sometimes with books of poetry, you can say, oh, what's the thin volume on the shelf? Olio is not that. Olio takes up space, and it's got, like, it's got girth, and it's got pages that fold out, that go beyond what the like perceived constraints of, like, maybe a book medium is. And, like, hats off to you for thinking of it, to break it, and to Wave Books for being partners in making it, like, a physical artifact in the world, as your vision showed it to could be.
Yeah, Wave Books was really kind of, you know, this book would not have really been possible without Wave, because there is almost no other publisher that I can think of that would have done what they did with this book. And the only reason that the book is like this is the book is essentially 8.5 by 11. And it's, I would say, roughly 1.5 inches thick or so, something like that. It's 300-odd pages. So, you know, the only reason that it's like that is and the fold-out pages are there only because they're there to accommodate the shape of the poems.
Yes.
And it's they're it's necessary, really, for them to be for the reader to be able to read the entire poem and not squint. Although my eyesight is terrible now, and I still have to squint. But that's the only reason. And part of that reason is because there are a lot of contrapuntal poems.
Yes. Can you talk about the contrapuntal, was that something where you were thinking, this is a form that fits this duality of experience? Or, I mean, with the twins,
right.
Like, in a way, maybe that poem, that's one of the fold-out poems where you see a shape that you design with the words on the page.
Right. And it's that is a concrete poem, and that it takes on the shape. A concrete poem is a poem that looks on the page in the shape of the image of the actual subject of the poem. So say if you were to write a poem about a butterfly, the shape of the words on the page would look like a butterfly.
And the contrapuntal is more like often binary, but it could be more. But it speaks to each other, right?
Yeah. Well, in the contrapuntal, so we're talking about a few different concepts that are flying around right now. But the contrapuntal poem is in this case, think of a conversation or an argument in which there's a point and a counterpoint. And in this case, there's on one side of the page of the poem, you will see one voice. On the other side, you will see another voice. And those two voices are in response to each other. However, when they are read across both lines, they read as one voice. So you end up having basically three voices. That is the voice of one party, the voice of the second party, and the conjoined voices of both parties. But I think I'll give you a quick example. Well, this isn't as quick, but this is a conjoined poem that is really based off of what I would call a found poem between Mark Twain.
I wondered if you were going to read this one.
Mark Twain, because this is an actual quote from Mark Twain that he wrote down. He said, fascinating character, Mark Twain. And Blind Tom, the person I was discussing earlier, who is autistic and blind. And so I'm going to say if you're looking at the page, it would be on the left side of the page. You would see Mark Twain's actual quote, which is, some archangel cast out of upper heaven, like another Satan.
What page is it? What if I shine my light on it, too?
Because
I could do... Hold on once. You know what? We could take... Let's take a short break. We're going to get the light on, and then we'll...
I got it. Some archangel cast out of upper heaven, like another Satan, inhabits this coarse casket, and he comforts himself, and he makes makes his prison beautiful with thoughts and dreams and memories of another time and another existence. That fire, this dull clod with, I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time, with impulse and inspirations it no more comprehends than does the stupid worm, the stirring of the spirit within, within her, of this gorgeous captive whose wings she fetters and whose flight she stays. That would be Mark Twain's side of the equation of the poem, so to speak. And Blind Tom's response would be, I'm sent from above, like rain on blue prayers, blessed with Gabriel's lost notes. I can see up to God's throne, yes, while he plays this soul of flesh free, makes me the music of piano, the breath and burn in the storm clouds roar from when sound called up first made me whole. Sounds like love. Sounds like love waited in my chest. It finds freedom after hurt. I hear earth's tremble, harsher, better than the soil itself. When land and tree sing to me, I hear notes wildly blooming inside. A spirit shadows across my face, breaking free, unloosed. I play the wind in my blood. Sorry, that was such a... My eyesight is not doing as well as it should be.
No, thank you for I would also say Blind Tom's, which is your writing, I know.
Right.
It was so different to hear, because I think I didn't read it out loud when I read it.
Uh-huh.
I read it across first.
Ah, okay.
But so when you're thinking of with this... Would you want, the reader's going to probably do what they're going to do, but would you say, the idea would be to read the left column first, the Mark Twain in this case, and then the right, and then read it across, blend?
I don't really have any control over that.
No. So
I have to release that, and I think it's my message to the reader is to try to explore it in the ways that they see fit. I think that it is suggested by the caesura that goes down the middle of the poem that there will be, that you will eventually come to the conclusion that you can read one side separately from the other.
Yes. And to kind of go to link it back to... Well, do you want to read the whole
thing? Yeah, I'll give it a shot.
With the eyes, it's okay?
Yeah. I think I can get this. Okay. So together it reads, some archangel I'm sent from above, cast out of upper heaven, like rain on blue prayers. Like another Satan, blessed with Gabriel's lost notes, I inhabits this coarse casket. Can see up to God's throne. And I guess I'll leave it at that. That's kind of like the first four kind of lines of that. I have to come back. I should have brought it up on my laptop. I can see it a lot better there.
You can hear how, like, as you said, like, there's that sojura, mm-hmm. but there's still this this blendedness that you're right. working with to shape. Is that, when you're working in this form, is this something that you can start feeling comes to you more naturally? You know, like, this isn't at all the same, but you know, if you were writing a bunch of limericks, you might almost start hearing everything in that sort of movement. But when you see these and hear it, is it coming to you more, or are you piecing it together visually with the text?
I think that what I do start doing is I look at, like, for instance, this is with found text. So it was kind of extraordinarily hard because the task was not to change any of the actual text. So that was a challenge. But you start looking at text, you know, as if, or I would start looking at text to see whether, how compatible it would be with another conversation. So there were a few quotes, but that was one that I was like, okay, I think, you know, if I wrestle with this, I can make it happen. Yeah.
And you did.
Yeah.
You did. Let's take a short break.
Thank you.
When we come back, more today, Tayemba Jess is here, the book Olio on the table with us. We've got Jason behind the glass. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you're just in time. Today on the program, Tayemba Jess is here. The book on the table with us, Olio, out with Wave Book Press, Wave Books. Tayemba, so why the song?
That's Little Walter right there, yeah, with a cut named Roller Coaster. Little Walter on the harmonica. I'm gonna forget the rest of the personnel. I'm very sorry to say. I'll have to remedy that in the future. However, that cut became something like number two or so the early 1950s. Little Walter used to play with Muddy Waters, and then he branched off. Formed his own really great band. I think it was Little Walter and the Jukes, and they were very hot back in the day, very hot. Little Walter was an innovator in harmonica, in that his one of his main contributions, you were listening to it right there, is that he figured out how to really amplify the art of amplifying a microphone. A harmonica. And really, harmonica is the first instrument to be electronically distorted. So as a result, so what you're hearing, he made the harmonica sound like a saxophone, which is why Muddy Waters dug him so much. And so whenever you talk to, you know, harmonica players, they talk about Little Walter with a certain kind of reverence, in that he kind of revolutionized the understanding of what a harmonica could do, especially when it's attached to a PA system.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And
that's just innovative. A rockin' tune. That tune is just rock and roll all over. You see the roots of rock and roll right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So for you, when you were growing up, mm-hmm. was it about music for you first, and then poems, and then slam poems, or how, like, or was it always one and the same? Or,
well, I grew up right down the street in Detroit. Detroit, Motown, and you know, I grew up, you know, listening to, you know, growing up in Detroit in the, you know, 70s, 80s, it was interesting mix, because on one hand, you hear Motown, all the, you know, like, just, it was in the heart of Motown, like, the block I grew up on. I grew up essentially kitty corner from Marvin Gaye. I went to school with one of the Four Tops sons. You know, Gladys Knight's kids went to the high school I went to, U of D, shout out. So that was like all over. And then at the same time, you know, there was this strong, like, rock kind of vibe happening. Yeah, like, so there was WLLZ, was a whole lot of Led Zeppelin. You could hear Led Zeppelin anytime you wanted to. and then there was this great, amazing DJ called the Electrifying Mojo, who would come on, I can't remember which it was, maybe GPR or something like that. I can't, it was 107 0.5, I can't remember. But Electrifying Mojo had this deep voice.
What a great name, too.
And he would land the mothership over the city of Detroit, and require you to dance in your bed or in your car, or if you were in the bathtub, to splash. And he would merge kind of both of those worlds together. And this new wave was happening, etc. And he was you know, that was one of the first vehicles where I really heard Prince, you know. And Prince, you know, hearing Prince, somebody says, oh, you, if you like Prince, you'll probably like Jimi Hendrix. Oh, who's Jimi Hendrix? Oh, okay. So, you know, get into some Jimi Hendrix, and then it goes in multiple directions. And and at the same time, you know, around 15, you know, getting intrigued by something that sounded like poetry, and then, you know, wondering of what it was, and trying to figure it out. And then at 18, I entered a NAACP AXO competition in the city of Detroit, which I won second prize in. And that was really, really amazing.
Because then it's like, someone hears me.
Yeah, like, well, it was like, you know what, maybe you should give it a shot. You know, you never know. Yeah. And that was a real Dudley Randall, actually, was who was a famous black poet out of Detroit, you know, a famous publisher. Dudley Randall was one of the judges. I did not know who he was at the time.
So you're knighted in a way.
Well, he was on the panel, and apparently he heard something that some other people didn't, which was great, you know. And I was writing about Detroit at the time, a poem called The Streets. And, you know, that kind of held my imagination. And then I went to Chicago, and I really discovered the blues because, you know, in Chicago, there was a very vibrant blues scene. Checkerboard Lounge, Rose's Lounge.
Is Kingston, you know, Mines what?
Kingston Mines was reggae. Wait, was it? Yeah, I'm pretty sure Kingston Mines was, well, no, Kingston Mines was, I'm thinking a while here. Yeah, Kingston Mines was still there. And then there was a few other places, Lee's Unleaded, you know, et cetera. And, you know, you could go to the clubs and see Buddy Guy, Junior Wells, Lefty Diz, a great harmonica that I know now, if you ever, you know, Billy Branch, who we'll get to later on. But I got to see it up close, and...
you're like 19 at this
point. I'm 19, yeah, about 19 years old. And I'm just thunderstruck. And it also made me curious as how to resolve the, you know, the kind of ecstasy of the blues with a real kind of political imagination or political analysis at the same time. And fortunately, I ran into a man who's really kind of my mentor today, is Sterling Plump, later on in my college career. And I took a class from him, and his writing merged the two in a way that I had not understood could be really done. And, you know, it that brought me in college. I drifted away from poetry because poetry is a completely unrealistic idea of a career. and I drifted into other things. But then I drifted back. And
but what was the drift? Like, or what?
Well,
was,
you know,
it slam poetry?
Well,
was
I did slam. I slammed, but before I tried to do a bunch of 9-to-5 jobs. That would have been, I mean, at this point, I probably should be retiring from a long career as a social service position. I would quit the jobs or they would fire me. So
this is kind of the life of the poet, though.
It is a little bit finding yourself. And what I discovered along the way was, you know, when I wrote, things started, you know, it worked better for me. You know, things started like... it was one of those things where if you find out that you're good at something and you like it, you really dig it, then, you know, try to, and you can figure out a way to make a living out of it, then you should really give it your 1,000%, you know. And that's basically what happened. You know, I was kind of trying to figure things out. It took me a very long time. You know, people were patient with me. Thanks, fam. Eventually, I did end up going into slam because slam. I used to do a lot of open mics in Chicago, and that was really my first real poetry family. And then I went into slam, and the slam was a whole. This is in the late '90s, so slam was, you know, I was at the Green Mill in Chicago, which was. The genesis, you know, of slam. You know, it's where it all started. And that was a place where you could really just, they would literally boo you off the stage. Right. You know.
Talk about tough crowds.
Yeah. So that was a real kind of another kind of schooling in the crafts of grabbing somebody's attention at the beginning of a poem and dragging them through it. And
performance, like how, like we were talking about embodying the research, but embodying the poem.
Yeah. Being able to read a poem with some degree of, you know, I think that, you know, I think that what Slam did is it brought a kind of idea of vivacity of mm-hmm. of the sonic understanding of the poem back into and it also kind of put poetry back out of the exclusive realm of the academy.
Yes.
And I think that's what was really Mark Smith, I think, who is the founder of Slam, deserves a lot more credit, I think, than he's gotten. He was really like the institution of Slam has touched literally millions of people around the world. If you had people who have slammed, people who have attended slams, mm-hmm. you know, in the way that it has brought the voice of just ordinary people. It could be a, you know, cab driver, it could be a, you know, a doctor, you could be, you know, a trash man, whatever. You get up on the stage and you become like, you have an entry into this space that will listen to your work. And even when the feedback is negative or when the feedback is, you know, you have the opportunity to move the crowd and have them hear your story. And also when you tell it well, you know, you can, you know, you... It just provided this venue where you could really bring that story and that poem and that image to a larger audience. So I think it was a very critical juncture in American poetry. Slam, Mark Smith.
And do you bring that, like, your knowledge of this also into what you do,
right,
as an instructor? Like in your work teaching and working with students who want.
I do. You know, I mean, for a while I taught slam in Chicago. I taught performance poetry. And now as a professor, my thesis, and this is, I think the person probably best embodies this is another poet named Patricia Smith.
Yes, friend of the show. Yeah.
Right. Who's an amazing poet, came through slam, and merged the page and the stage like perfectly.
Yes.
So I learned a lot from listening to Patricia Smith. Another guy, Tim Siebels, who I think is just an amazing, who's one of the first people I read where I was like, oh, I know this dude. This is like talking to some ordinary, like some cat off the block, you know? So
right, and the language, right, where you can be like, this language,
right,
is what I can connect with,
right,
these poems, like my poems,
right,
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 or so.
Yeah. So those folks, you know, there was a lot of, I think that Slam was definitely a changing point for me, and it taught me that if I work hard on the page, so you have to work less on the stage.
Oh, you know, that sounds like like a saying.
It is. It's for me. It is. Right. How do you work on the page less? You have to work on the stage, because I mean, you know, a good performer can read the phone book and make it sound like a story, but in the end, you have to. There has to be something there. It has to be a story. There has to be an image. There has to be something for people to hold on to.
And is that what keeps you also in the poems and in the making and in the seeking?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it can be a challenge. It's always a challenge, you know, to do this and to get it to it with some degree of pith and gravity, you know, in a short amount of time, you know, because, you know, well, I mean, there's all kinds of ways to be a poet in the world, but I think another lesson is economy, you know, it's saying the most with the least, yeah.
this like a spare quality.
Yeah, yeah. To try, that is you know, you have in other forms of literature, you have a lot more space to run around, so to speak. And mm-hmm. in poetry, you're talking about, sometimes you're counting syllables.
Yeah.
You know,
depending on the form, if you're working in that.
Right. Yeah. And sometimes you're counting lines and, you know, things of that nature. So you have a limited amount of space in order to make something happen and then break off. Yeah.
But you're like, you appreciate that constraint like that.
Yeah.
And knowing it and breaking it, which is clear with Olio.
Right. Well, you know, in constraint, one can find new ways of expression that are a liberation.
Yes. Yes. So things you wouldn't have found.
Right. Exactly.
First off.
Exactly.
Perhaps.
It because out of necessity, you start to think in different ways that move your work or your craft in a different direction that you hadn't expected.
Yeah. Your own thinking.
Yes.
Like you were saying, your discoveries.
Right.
Too.
Right. Yeah.
Because it could be in an archive, but it could be in the synergy of the spark of making or so as you're
right.
You're in it.
Right.
So what are you working on now? And would you mind reading something for
sure.
us?
Well, you know, you just heard from little Walter. So trying to work on some poems about you know, I just figured out why not write some poems about harmonica players.
Especially because you play.
I do. I mess around with it. You know. So this one is Little Walter. Anthem of diatonic memory, crushed coiled in your fist. Proclamation of crystal diode emancipation. Muddy Waters, Attorney General, in prosecution of the beat behind each sway. The liquored indigo folded around us, soldered in sun. The lowly harp, electroshocked into demigod of direct current. Sledging Mississippi depths to release the body sacrifice. Razor blading the edges off cotton fielded shuffles. Forecasting generations of blues scaled scholars. Reinterpreting a tongue dragged through bottle, cross thigh, scattered to transistorized wind.
Thank you. Thank you, Tayamba. Thank you.
Fun, yeah.
So this poem, that's a Little Walter poem, this is part of the next manuscript?
Or, I hope so.
Or what is that, what the idea is now? Like, is
yeah, I'm just, you know, just messing around, seeing what happens, you know, with it. You know, not at this point as inclined to go as deep into Little Walter, like a kind of biography of Little Walter, although that could happen. We'll see.
Okay.
At this point, I'm content to just, you know, graph his imprint in words on the page.
Well, thanks for reading that one today.
Absolutely.
Because mm-hmm. I could talk with you for another hour.
Wow, has it been an hour?
Yes.
That's crazy.
We're getting there. But I should say, like, for folks out there listening too, because you're in town for the Zell Visiting Writer Series.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
I'd be amiss if I didn't mention that everyone can come and see you tomorrow.
Please do.
At UMA in the Stern Auditorium, 5:30. So it's Thursday, February 6th. At UMA, the Stern Auditorium, with a reading and a Q&A. Can
yep.
I play any harmonica or
we'll
no?
See.
You know?
We'll see.
Oh,
we'll see.
Oh, I should have asked you to, had I known, I would have asked you to bring it for today. And then on Friday, the next day in the morning, at the Robert Hayden Conference Room in Angel Hall, 10 o'clock, your craft talk.
Oh, yeah.
And this is going to be music and poems.
Yes. Yeah. Talk about, you know, the synthesis of music and poetry. Or writing about music and what it can be, you know, what ways it can happen, how, you know, I guess my methodology when I'm thinking about doing it. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah.
And for Olio and for what's coming down.
Oh, thank you.
Down next. And I'd just like to thank Jason for being behind the glass today. Thanks, Jason. Thanks everyone for listening. And we've got another good song featuring harmonica to go out on. You've been listening to Living Writers today on the program, Diimba Jazz. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.
There are 219 passed up by my chair. Whoa, I'm gonna take it and set it right down. Or when the blues overtake me, I'm gonna rock on with you. The blue. Live from Ann Arbor, welcome back to the Daily Sports Report here on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm your host, Vihan Iswar, and I've just got one panelist for me today, so it's going to be a small panel, but it's going to be a great one. It's going to be me and Evan today. Evan, how you doing?
Doing pretty good. How are you?
Pretty solid. The weather dropping a few degrees after a week of fake 34-degree weather is not super pleasant, but I think that just comes with the territory of going to school here at Michigan.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, and so for today's show, we're going to be going a little bit more historical, a little bit more speculative than we tend to usually go, but still got a fun one planned. So NFL Honors is tomorrow night, I believe, on Thursday. And yep. On yesterday's show, we broke down just the awards picks. I don't really think there's a lot of controversy with a lot of the awards. I think we're at the point where there's very rarely too many surprises just because of the way AP voters figure out. I think mostly everyone has figured out where they're going to go. But Hall of Fame voting is still pretty open-ended. And this is a very interesting class. You've got a few. This is probably the first class that is going to consist of at least a few players that I watched a large portion of their careers. And I'm sure, Evan, you can speak on the same. So it's a little different to actually weigh on these debates instead of talking about someone who my dad watched.
Yeah, never getting a chance to see him or anything like that.
Yeah, a few years ago when it was discussing things like guys like, I don't know, like Terrell Owens, Randy Moss, Ray Lewis, it's like, yeah, these guys are great. Yeah, they belong.